Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Eastern Arc podcast series. My name is Phil Ward and I'm the director of the Eastern Arc Regional Research Consortium that brings together the universities of East Anglia, Essex and Kent. Normally these podcasts are a chance to hear about the research going on within each of the three universities. We focus on a contemporary issue and examine it from a number of different perspectives, bringing in the thoughts of those who've spent a lifetime examining the underlying issues. Today we're going to be focusing instead on a funder, the National Institute for Health Research, or NIHR. Established in 2006, the NIHR has an annual budget of more than £1 billion. It funds health and social care and has been seen as the research arm of the NHS. However, many who do research that is relevant to the funder are deterred from applying because its structure can seem confusing, its priorities obscure, and its processes unclear. This podcast is a recording of a live event we held in March 2022, which provided a clear, straightforward overview of how the funder is structured, its 10 basic schemes, and how applications are assessed, together with insights into how you can frame your application for the best chance of success and where you can find out more. Taking part in the event were four colleagues involved in two research design services, RDSs, which provide help and support for applicants to the NIHR. Professor Andrew Bateman is based at Essex and is director of the NIHR Research Design Service for the East of England, as well as head of the Division of Interdisciplinary Research and Practice in the School of Health and Social Care. Professor Gary Barton is a professor of health economics at UEA, as well as deputy director and site lead for the NIHR RDS-EOE. There's a lot of acronyms that are going to come your way in a minute. He is a panel member for the NIHR Advanced Fellowships, PDF, and Programme Grant for Applied Research, PGFAR, applications. Dr. Farhana Hashem is a reader in health services research in the Centre for Health Services Studies at the University of Kent. She is Kent's site lead for the RDS South East of England. She has written for Research Professional explaining the focus and structure of NIHR for those unfamiliar with it. And finally, Professor Tracy Sack is also a Professor of Health Economics at UEA. She's currently Chair of the NIHR Research for Patient Benefit East of England Research Advisory Committee. As we listen in on their discussion, do bear in mind that they are not speaking on behalf of the NIHR and that any comments should not be taken as official NIHR policy or guidance, but rather advice based on their personal experience. We join the event as a discussion turns to the question of who can apply to the NIHR. Is it just for well-established professors with global reputations, or is there room for early and mid-career researchers who are perhaps just establishing themselves? Tracy offers an answer.
I'm happy to talk about this. So one of the benefits of the RFPB is that they do encourage early career researchers, and I think even with the HJS, I've had experience of sitting on their funding panels, early career researchers would be okay if they were supported and had a co-applicant, a joint co-lead. So it's about having the right support in place and applying. So I think actually the NIHR is quite open generally to early career researchers if they're well supported in applying.
And is the Research for Patient Benefit, the RFPB, particularly open to early career researchers?
I don't think there's a particular preference, but I wouldn't be surprised if you looked at the underlying figures that quite a high proportion of people that get their first grant might be through the RFPB programme. Because you can get different levels of funding, it makes the programme quite accessible. If you want that small first step at developing your grant, you can apply for a Tier 3, which is up to £150,000 for a project. Whereas more experienced you are, you can apply for Tier 1 funding, which is up to £350,000. So it kind of lends itself to people that want to make that first step.
I mean, one of the privileges in the RDS of being able to observe the panels gives us this little insight into how funding panels work, and that type of conversation that would happen if somebody put in, say, 1% of a very senior professor, and actually the work is going to be done by 90% of a research fellow. The conversation in the panel is, well, why aren't they the PI? You know, what's going on here about bringing on, and there's a capacity development conversation that happens around this. So these are the kinds of nuances of how the bid is pitched that people can look at.
Picking up on your 1% there, FTE, generally, if you have lots of co-applicants that are on low percentages, that doesn't look good on an application, because who is actually going to do the work?
That's interesting. So there has to be good balance between the amount of work that they're undertaking and the amount of money and time that they're seeking to do it. This would be a good point to look at actually how it works in the panels themselves. How does it work in practice in terms of assessing applications?
So stage one, it's looked at by the panel. And the panel's mainly composed of methodologists, but also experts in particular clinical areas. So we'll score the application on a 0 to 10 scale, where 8 and above is where we think it should be funded, essentially. And then it's sent out for peer review after stage one. Stage one essentially is convincing the panel it's an important question. And that's really what we're looking for. It's answering that so what question.
So at stage one, it's assessed for the so what. And at stage two, it's goes to the full panel, as I understand it. Is there a difference between, is it a two-stager in terms of the size of the application going in? Is it just an outline at the first stage and a full application at the second?
The second stage, you get a chance to respond to the feedback you've received at stage one in detail. And you also, as you say, get a chance to submit a more full application describing the project.
Tracy, do you want to talk about the RFPB experience?
Yeah, I can do. So the panel's probably around, I mean, it varies over time, but it's roughly around 12 to 15 people made up of, in a similar way as Gary described for the other panel, of methodologists and clinicians. The applications is similar process at stage one, only the panel consider it. And some get removed before panel, so they don't actually make it to the panel. They get triaged out if they're clearly out of remit. If there's clearly something wrong with them, for instance, there might be one applicant who hasn't got the skill set to do all of the work. So that's obvious, it's not going to get funded. But all of those the ones that triage that get removed, and the ones after stage one all get feedback. So everyone that applies gets feedback, and with the programme, you can reapply. I know for some programmes like the HTA, you have to wait a year to reapply. If you're invited back to stage two, you get 4 weeks to put your 3 application, which is the lower cost applications. They don't all get sent out, but you don't get a chance to respond to that feedback as an applicant. Only the panel see that feedback, which is slightly different to HTA, where you would get an opportunity to respond to the feedback. Just because of the timescales of the process, it doesn't allow for feedback at that stage. And then the second panel, the committee, when it comes back, will consider that feedback with the application and make a decision. I think it's worth pointing out what the success rates of the programme are, to give you some flavour of how likely you are. So of all the people that apply, about 18%, 18 to 20% get funded. But if you look through, if you get to stage two, then the funding rate, success rate, is about 50-60%. So actually, once you get to stage two, you've got quite good odds.
It's always worth knowing the success rates. It shouldn't be a deal breaker, but it's really useful going into it with your eyes open and knowing what your chances are. So you mentioned 18 to 20% for stage one. So is that the chances of success of being funded, or the chances of success of going through to stage two, if you see what I mean?
Oh yeah, no, that's the overall rates. You've got a 1 in 5 chance of getting funded. But if you get to stage two, that then increases. So if you're invited to stage two, then the success rate increases from about 18-20% to the 50-60%. But even if you get rejected at stage one, you can reapply, use the feedback you've got from the committee, and put a new application in. And that does happen a lot. People do reapply, and if they take on board the feedback, then that increases their chances, really.
That's really interesting. Do you have to be invited to resubmit, or can you just say, right, that sounds like that feedback is something I can take on board and I will go for it again? Is it something you specifically have to be invited to? Is it something that is just part of the culture of NIHR?
Just the culture. So you can just choose to, you don't have to be invited, you can just choose to reapply. Sometimes the panel might give us a steer if they particularly liked it and it was a close one that was on the borderline of probably going through or not. They might give you a sentence in the feedback that indicates that they would like you to come back. But even if you don't get that, that's not a reason not to reapply. if you can address the feedback points.
That's interesting, and I don't want to get hung up on success rate stats, but is there any sense of the success rate for resubmissions?
That's a good question. No, I haven't seen that broken down. As a committee member, you recall seeing previous applications, so you do know they get through and they get funded.
Thanks, Tracy. And I see Farhana shaking her head, so I assume those figures aren't available. Andrew, did you want to come in there?
I was thinking about how this differs from other funding panels. You know, so from some councils where, you know, you simply can't. What I've heard is the positivity, you know, that the reviewers say, oh, you know, this is the second or third time we've seen this. They've responded to our feedback and they're really, you know, positive. They are actually there because they are upbeat about wanting to do research. The only other thing I was going to just mention is you might get a note saying it's out of scope, you know, and that's about it being in scopeness that is the reason for it not proceeding. I think this myth that you can't reapply is a good one to be talking about as a chat like this, because I think that's one of the most common things I've seen is people kind of just kind of give up and walk away rather than really taking on board the feedback that is provided. And it's pretty fulsome feedback. You know, it's precise. And I might add that that's one of the reasons the Research Design Service exists, is to support people to hopefully avert not getting through stage one. We've got, as an RDS, quite a good idea of what a getting through stage one bid looks like. You're not obliged to use the Research Design Service, but if you do, we have a hunch that we can nudge the chance of getting through.
I think that's really important. I know I supported, when I first started in this role, supported a group of people putting into the NIHR who were unsuccessful, and I tried to encourage them to look at other possible funding. But there wasn't a sense at that stage of even thinking of resubmitting to the NIHR. So knowing that you can go into it with the possibility of reconfiguring or taking on board that feedback and making the application more relevant, perhaps, to the NIHR is a really important one. There's a question from Bernard. So the question is there a sense what proportion of the panel decision-making process is geared towards three things? One is the impact of the study. One is the PPI, the patient and public involvement, their contribution. And three is the support team. And Bernard says, understanding this proportion may differ for different schemes. Any thoughts on that? Farhana, shall I come to you first?
I don't think you can put a figure on it. It needs to be embedded throughout. I mean, I think alarm bells will go off immediately when there is, you know, very minimal mention of public involvement during the design of the study. You can't put a science to it. There's no proportion.
I wasn't going to say that. I was going to say the same, really. There's no proportions that you'd expect to look at all of them. They're all really important, like you say, particularly the PPI. If that's not embedded throughout, then it makes you question whether it will be going forward.
So in terms of the reviews they get, do they have a peer review college or anything like that, or can it be anyone across both academia, the NHS, so forth, national and international? Is there a set group of people, or can it be anyone?
So I think, to answer your question, it can be sent to anyone. Obviously, on the application form, you may get a chance to nominate some reviewers, and they may use some of those. The NHR will have a database of previous applicants. As an applicant yourself, you might find that you're suddenly asked to review things after being an applicant, even if you get rejected. So they do tend to have a database of potential reviewers, and they may well have to send out 5 review requests just to get one response. So they do have to send out quite a lot of requests to get responses to reviewers. So they do therefore make lots of requests for reviews, I think, in order to receive just one or two back, which is a bit of an administration task.
That general advice that if you get involved in reviewing, that's a great way of learning. And I'm sure, like Gary says, I know that once I had submitted one RFPB bid many years ago, after that I got to review others, and I definitely learned more over the years from review being part of that process, getting a chance to think about it independently, and then trying to apply that scrutiny to myself in future bids, and now as part of the day job. trying to help other people think objectively about what they've written.
Thanks, Andrew. Is there a formal way of getting involved in it, or you just wait for the bat signal from NIHR on being involved?
So if you wanted to be on a funding panel and become a funding panel member, you can look on Google or NIHR jobs, and they'll advertise regularly for members of new panels. So there are advertised opportunities that anyone can apply for. In terms of peer reviewing, I'm not sure there's a process for volunteering as such, not for the RFPB programme anyway. But I'm sure if you contacted the programme managers, their details are on the RFPB website, they'd happily include your details.
I want to move on slightly to both the focus and the priorities of the NIHR, but also in terms of, you know, costs and so forth. In terms of focus, I see a question in the chat from Fahana Lisa about the NIHR's perception towards artificial intelligence methodologies. And I'd welcome your thoughts on that. Is it something that the NIHR is interested in? And is there any specific calls or the use of methodologies more broadly? Fahana, can I come to you perhaps on that?
I think there have been AI calls in recent times, and there have been, those might, I don't know if they fall under the commissioned calls, but those are set up separately. That's my understanding, and they perhaps fall out. Some of them may fall out of the sort of traditional funding programmes. That's probably isn't as much as I can advise you. We probably advised on one in Kent, and it was successful, thankfully, but it was a partnership between, you know, the university did quite a bit of the public involvement, but the industry partner had quite a strongly developed idea already. But it is about, like with a lot of NIHR grants, is that it's about bringing the HEI, the commercial sector, the partner, as well as an NHS host together.
I was just going to say, I've put in the chat box a link to the funding awards database, fundingawards.nihr.ac.uk. And if you just look for artificial intelligence in there, you'll see there are 82 studies that have been awarded so far. One of the things I would say I've observed in bids coming through with this type of technology being mentioned as front and center is often the applicants have lost sight of what the problem is they're solving. So we have to kind of emphasize that this is about applied research that's going to make a difference to the health and wealth of people, you know, of the nation, is the kind of catchphrase. So it needs to be really clear that the pathway from the technology that's been used, whatever research method you're using, you know, is going to deliver the impact that you want it to deliver. And I think quite often when we've worked with people that are in mathematics, statistics, pure science, and most of their working life, it's that we've mentioned it, the PPI connection, the patient and public involvement, the plain English explanation of it, it has to all fit together. And when it doesn't, the panel who are ultimately, you know, if it needs to go to expert peer review, it does, but it's, you've got to think about who you're convincing about your proposal as well.
I think in those cases, you know, where is the patient benefit? That sort of gets lost when a partner wants to promote a sort of snazzy new technology or an intervention. I think what the clear message needs to be drawn out is patient benefit, and that's how that's going to be demonstrated through how you're going to measure that.
Thanks, Fahana. The other Fahana Lisa, do you want to come back on that?
So my research is in artificial intelligence and computer science. I'm currently working with one of the GPs, working on the development of an app. So is that like I can apply, or the industry partner who has to be the PI or main applicant in such calls?
It's important that you get that you do your public involvement. You need to see whether whether patients and the public, whether they think your app is of value. It's really important to start there. That would be my advice. And you need to define what your research question is. So you might have the technology itself, but what is the question you're trying to address? What are you trying to answer? And some of that can be informed by your patient, by your public involvement. And in terms of who can apply, you know, it depends on the funding programme. Generally, you'd have to pick a suitable funding programme that would fund your particular app. But I think, I will say as a disclaimer, NIHR are quite cautious about funding tech type of bids, there's got to be a patient benefit clearly illustrated, and you've got to demonstrate that you've done that work before going on to the next stage of actually making an application.
Thanks, thanks both for Hannah's on that one. Going to Rob's question about essentially the tagline for NIHR, Andrew mentioned that broadly it's applied research for the benefit of the health and wealth of the nation, and it has to be for patient benefit. Would anyone on the panel differ from that? Would there be further clarification of actually what the NIHR is about? How do, you know, is there a snappy way of summarising in a sentence or two?
I was going to say there's a long answer, in that there's a really great document called let me just get the right title because I always get the words in the wrong order. It's called Best Research for Best Health, and there's been a revision to it just recently called Best Research for Best Health, the next chapter, imaginatively called. and I really, really recommend engaging with that document, because it also, what that does is it gives you the thrust of where the NIHR is heading in this next period. There are some really key themes in it. For example, you know, studies need to really identify how they're dealing with issues of diversity amongst our patient groups or populations. I should emphasize, I saw somebody ask about NHS clinicians as well, and I could answer that. The NIHR is actually shortly to be announcing its revised name. It is actually the National Institute for Health and Social, National Institute for Health and Care Research. So the point is that funding does go, as Farhana mentioned, to social care, which could be a local government or a third sector or voluntary organisation. So it's not NHS clinicians only, and certainly for the research for social care funding stream, sometimes that really does make sense that it's only university-based people that are applying. But the message, I think, if we landed one message in all of this chat today, it's how the studies that you're proposing will find their way into use. The pathway to impact is examined really carefully.
I see another question from Deborah about seed funding available to assist with setting up PPI groups in order to establish and gather evidence for patient benefit. Because I imagine, I see where Deborah's coming from on that, because I imagine it can be quite an involved and long process in identifying and engaging those groups that should be involved in the work. So is there any seed funding to enable that level of engagement?
We do have some sort of what you might call seed funding within the RDS, where we might, you know, put a few hundred pounds together to try and enable people to undertake PPI at that initial stage of, you know, setting up the research question, thinking through the project at that early stage. I think it's very useful to get PPI involvement, so we can help with that.
There's a whole section about our expectations of what, how much funding should be made available per person per hour for members of the public to be involved. So you, in through a study, you know, for example, I think it would be pretty normal these days to expect a member of the public to be on the project steering group. So if that project steering group is going to meet monthly for 2 hours, then multiply that up for the duration of the study, and that's a minimum. And then if you're going to involve them in workshops or focus groups, this is not just a tick box and other exercise. This is central and fundamental to the pathway to impact.
I should point out this, it's also true for methodological projects. So you can include patient and public involvement even in what might seem quite an esoteric topic like economic modelling or something. There are still expectations that you would have that input.
Just on that, in terms of RDS support, do all of the regional RDSs provide, are they all structured in the same way, provide the same level of support, have that same seed corn funding, or is there differences, are there differences between the different regions in what is offered?
It's marginal differences. I think for the to all intents and purposes, the RDSs have a budget, and typically that, you know, that can pay for a pre-submission workshop, a focus group, or some interviews. This is where we're getting into the weeds of what an RDS advice consultation would look like, but our support system that would take you through that process.
I mean, having an RDS seems like a huge benefit, a huge bonus to have someone who can help and stand alongside you in the application process. Is there any limit to how much you can use them?
Technically, no. But I think, so you might, for us, we might get a project, we might get one researcher submitting what we call a support request, you know, for two or three projects at the same time. And the back end of things, we would have to have a look up who's available to support that. So technically, no. But we would also make a call whether that study really is in its infancy and it's really at first principles. And but we're very approachable, and we would certainly have a conversation with people who put in a support request. And then we might say to somebody, well, you're quite early stages, perhaps you need to do X, Y, and Z, and then we can have another conversation. It really depends the stage at which the team and the project is at.
And leading on from that, is there a sweet spot as to when people should approach the RDS?
But there's certain things the RDS we don't tend to take on. We don't tend to write the application for the individual, so we expect the applicant to lead on that. And we also have to be conscious about the fact we're advising on the application, but the applicant themselves will have to deliver the project as well. So they have to take some ownership of the application and the design in that sort of regard. So we won't tend to write the application and lead the application for them, because we're conscious they have to deliver the project.
Thanks, Gary. Going to Bernard's question, I think this is a really interesting one, and perhaps you can't advise, but is the NIHR, and maybe it's specific schemes, but is the NIHR geared more towards pragmatic, safe, cost-effective treatments now rather than innovative, risky treatments that perhaps might only become the next standard of care a few years later? And by risky and safe, Bernard clarifies he means the chance it might work or fail. Tracy.
Yeah, so I think when we're assessing, like, for instance, feasibility studies that come to us, you would expect some kind of evidence to indicate there might be efficacy, or you might be able to explain the mechanism by which something would work. So I think it's about how you write the application for these risky things. If you can demonstrate there's a plausible mechanism by which it might work, and have some, say, pilot study data that might support that, or some literature that supports that, then I think that would be fine. I think it's also with the programme, because, well, for the RFPB programme anyway, the different tiers reflect how much risk the programme's willing to take on a particular project as well. So if they're going to spend the highest tier of 350k, they might be a bit more risk averse than with the lower funding.
Okay. At that point, I think it would be quite nice to cut to the chase in terms of actually the costs and what can be applied for, what can't be applied for, what's out of scope in terms of those costs, and perhaps saying a little bit more about those different tiers, which have come up a couple of times in the discussion. So in terms of costs, first of all, are overheads included? I'm kind of assuming so, but just wanted to check that. Okay, I see some nodding there. That's good. And is it in line? Is it fully economically costed? Is it the same as research councils? And as part of that, before I come to answers, does the NIHR expect any kind of match funding from other sources in applications? Tracy.
So not all the programmes are for overheads. The programme grants don't put overheads, but they do fund 100% of the cost. So that's slightly different. I forgot what the other question now was I was going to answer.
Was match funding, yeah.
Oh, match fund. I don't think we tend to have match fund in the for patient benefit program. We don't have match funding, but sometimes applicants say they've got funding from other sources to fund a particular aspect of it, and they can describe the discrete aspect that that's being funded by, or someone on the team might be funded by another project, so they're not costing in their time, and that's fine as long as it's justified and clear exactly what's being funded.
Does that play well with the NIHR? That kind of demonstration of commitment from elsewhere?
I'm not sure they have a preference one way or the other, actually, as long as you're clear about what you're asking for funding and what's already been funded and why. So it's very clear what they're funding and what they're not funding. I don't think it would make a difference as long as it's well written.
In terms of the amount of funding offered by the NIHR, is there a split between the three different types of commissioned research, the research-led research and the themed research? Is there one that is dwarfs the other ones, one that is relatively underfunded? No, underfunded is the wrong word, that has a smaller pot of funding compared to the others. What's the general split between them?
I'd point people at the database of funding. If you search that by the programmes, you can see how, you know, an HTA bid may often be in the order of £1 million, whereas, you know, there is literally no way that an RFPB bid would be that size. I don't know if that answers your question, Phil. You know, there are funding calls that literally state there's no upper limit, but the panel are making a decision about value for money.
I guess a question related to that is there a clear place where the assessment criteria is set out for NIHR applications? So for the research councils, for instance, the research excellence is the top criteria. For NIHR, is it that benefit for the patients? Or can you give me a sense of what the criteria is in terms of the most important down to the least?
So I think it will vary by the actual funding programme. I think it's really important to read about the individual funding programmes and what they're looking for. They will all have different slants as to what they're looking for. And the question of funding, again, they will have different limits. But I think it's about justifying and explaining why if your programme is expensive, it's about explaining and justifying that cost in some respects. I sit on the programme grants and we have no upper limit. We don't tend to see grants over £2.5 million. But we certainly have funded them. And if you need a long-term follow-up to look for the time it takes those adverse events to happen or the benefits to accrue, and that hasn't been done before in previous research, for example, it's about explaining that and justifying why this is the first study to have this unique aspect, and therefore justifying why the costs are going to be high in that respect. So it's about explaining what this project contributes, and it's, you know, applied research is difficult. We know that. We know it's not necessarily easy thing to do, and therefore it might well take high costs to deliver those sort of projects. And so if that can be explained, then that's more likely to be understood by the committee, I think.
Thanks, Gary. Now, Emmy, you've clearly got more knowledge on this. I'm not sure what so ECAT, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, form is, but you're asking, do those forms, are they needed for all NIHR applications? And presumably RDS will want plenty advance notice of these. And for ignorant fools like me, could you just explain what a SOECAT form, if that's how you pronounce it, is? Thank you. Tracy, do you want to take this one?
So it's setting out your costs for your application. So it's SOECAT. I probably don't say it correctly either. So you would take the form to so your lead app organisation, which for the RFPB would be an NHS organisation or a public health one. And so it's them that would probably need time.
With some of the funding programmes, I think HSDR, I think, when you submit to stage two, you might be asked to submit the SOECAT form. And my understanding is I'm going to introduce a third part of the NIHR, the Clinical Research Network will need to sign that off for you. And I think there might be 13 clinical research networks. They don't neatly map onto the 10 regions of the RDSs. But you'll need to get one of the RDMs, the research delivery managers, or one of, and they will be sort of registered to sign off the SOECAT or the SOECAT form. It's really helpful to speak to your clinical research network at the earliest opportunity to help you complete that form as well. So we at the RDS, we will signpost you to your local CRM, basically.
The costings is mainly thinking account of what the funding panel and funding body will approve. So they generally provide the research costs, but there are other costs that you might need to incur to deliver the project. So there's the treatment cost, the cost of the intervention, and they're often referred to as NHS treatment costs. And they're not generally covered by the funding panel. So that's where you might need the sort of SOCAT, what was put in the chat about the excess NHS treatment costs. The SOCAT form is meant to identify those different aspects of treatment costs. And there's also the service support costs for the cost of recruitment and consent and those sort of aspects. But again, they're not necessarily covered by the funding body. And you might have to get the CRN involved again to estimate those costs. So it's all to do with the CORD and what will be covered by the grant and what extra costs you might need to deliver the project.
Thanks, Gary. I've got a couple of not nasty questions, open questions that I want to ask the panel. And they're broadly around whether they've noticed specific things that the NIHR favours, whether it be specific subjects, methodologies, elements of a project, and a final humdinger in terms of what their top tips, maybe up to three tips, are for applying to the NIHR. Tracy, can I come to you first in terms of research for public benefit?
The really good thing about the research for patient benefit is the wide range of methodologies and subject areas covered. So I think I have seen in the past they've put together where they're funding, and the funding is across all clinical areas and all different research methodologies. So no, it's more about whether the application's written well, whether you've taken the time to develop it, and whether the team's correct.
Okay, well, that was an easy one to answer. Fair enough. Gary Fahana, did you have anything to add to that, or does that sum it up quite nicely?
I mean, I would agree with what Tracy said. I'd agree with what Tracy said in terms of there's no one thing we're looking for, but the story is really important to in terms of funding. You'll be looked at on the panel by methodologists often that know nothing about your clinical area. And we might see 20 applications that we've got to talk to in one day, if you get what I mean. So you've got to think about the funding panel in that sort of context. So it's developing that story to a non-expert and explaining, you know, what your important contribution will be, what will change because of your project in that sort of context, but also justifying all the elements of your project in terms of why you've chosen this particular design, why you've got the appropriate team. It's all about justifying things to the people who won't know anything about your clinical area, essentially. So you have got to sell it to a certain extent.
Thanks, Gary. That's a useful point. Fahana, did you want to come in there?
I think a key message for me would be, you know, you really need to justify patient benefit. That's, you know, the critical and how that will be developed and explained in the application. I think that's a critical thing for me, rather than be dazzled by, as I said, a new technology or a new surgery technique. I would like to see patient benefit, you know, especially with something like RFPB in the next 3 to 5 years. I think that is really critical.
Okay, so coming to the last kind of summing up, perhaps, of some of the things we've covered today. We've covered an awful lot of ground. We've got to understand the different schemes. We've got a sense of how these applications are assessed. We've understood the costs involved. We've understood the specifics of involving the public and patients in any proposed project. So covered a lot of ground. And just to perhaps sum up, I do want to go around the panel to get their take on things which they want us to take away from this, the hints and tips or advice that they think is essential for applying to the NIHR. And I apologise beforehand for putting you all on the spot, but it would be really useful to get your thoughts on it. Andrew, can I come to you first?
I think the story of thinking about what priorities are happening in our country right now, you know, in terms of public health, and, you know, the conversations that are happening around the social care sector as well. And as I mentioned, the NIHR even really wanting to emphasize that it isn't just NHS, is going to be quite an exciting period, I think, that's going to bring new people. I think particularly given this is an Eastern ARC event, we thought that we should have this conversation with you, Phil, because I think there are researchers in the collaboration that haven't yet tried to work with NIHR, and thinking about how you work as a team how your institution, how your locality create the reason for this study to be absolutely, unarguably the right place for it to happen. Just why you, why your locality, you know, and what is it that you in your coastal community or you in your, you know, urban centre can solve problems that matter?
Thanks, Andrew. Tracy, thoughts, any final thoughts on things to bear in mind when applying to the NIHR from your experience?
I just wanted to say that you just need resilience, and there's plenty of advice out there. In fact, probably a lot of information. But and I think the key message I wanted to get across today is that you can reapply with NIHR schemes, and I think it's important to learn from the feedback and go forward. You get lots of knockbacks in research generally in terms of when you're publishing research and everything. So it's just the same as that. You just have to be resilient and be passionate about what you're doing.
That's really important, isn't it? Thank you very much. Fahana?
I would say that it is worth talking to the RDS. We inhabit the space between funding programmes, you know, and the host and those putting together the grant application. And we are that space in between to, you know, make up any knowledge gaps about the funding programmes. So if in doubt, it is worth getting in touch with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Fahana. Absolutely. When you've got a service like that, it would be crazy not to use it, particularly if you're new to the NIHR. And finally, Gary, final thoughts from you.
We can't overemphasise how important the path to patient benefit is, but you've also got to look at what your funding body you're applying to. And sometimes you can't do all of that in one application. So it might be you start with the RFPB, where you develop the application, the intervention, sorry. And that might be the focus of that project. But it's important, if that is what you're trying to do, just develop the intervention, that you still explain that research trajectory in terms of what you might do next in order to bring about the path to patient benefit. So it might be that you focus on a certain aspect in one study, but you do therefore have to also explain that research trajectory, what's going to go next in order to deliver the full trial, perhaps. And check you can therefore step from one thing to the other. So you do have to think about that bigger picture, even if you're just focusing on the initial aspect, maybe of developing the intervention or a feasibility study. They'll want to know what that sort of next step is to patient benefit. And one other aspect is to think about your literature review. We sometimes get questioned on the panel and we find out we don't like things being hidden from us in some respects. You might sometimes find out about a similar project that's been funded that they haven't mentioned in the application. And we do often come across those, and we do often wonder about the issue of overlap in terms of whether things are similar to what's already been funded. And I don't think the committee likes things being hidden from them in some respects. So I don't think you have to be necessarily concerned about that. I think that the committee would rather you be open about that and try and justify why your project is different, that, and acknowledge that you're aware of the literature. Give a balanced overview of what other projects are being undertaken, what your project adds in some respects and why it's different, rather than trying to hide things and being disingenuous and the committee finding about them later. Because we do recommend some things to funding and then find out there's overlap and it's similar to another project, and then we deem it not to be fundable because of overlap. But if the project had had a chance to explain why they're not necessarily overlap and they are different, then that might have been a different outcome in some respects.
That's an important message to end with and rounds off nicely the key points to bear in mind when applying to the NIHR. First, be aware of the wider strategy and national context. Second, make use of your RDS. Third, make sure the public and patients are fully involved and integrated into your project. Fourth, be clear and honest about other relevant research that may impact or be impacted by your own. And finally, and this is a message for all of us applying for research funding, be resilient. And in the case of the NIHR, make the most of that opportunity to resubmit. So my thanks to the panel, Andrew Bateman, Gary Barton, Fahana Hashem, and Tracy Sack, and to the live audience for the questions they provided. And to you for tuning in. Join me next time when we continue to explore the wider world of the Eastern Arc Consortium.